Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Allison Park Leadership Podcast, where we have culture creating conversations. My name is Dave.
And my name is Jeff. And we're so glad you joined us today. Of course, just to introduce ourselves again, I've been the pastor at Allison Park Church for the last 30 plus years. And Dave, of course, is my oldest son and pastor at our Northside campus. And we love these conversations that we get to have with you. So glad you've joined us today.
Yeah, no new gratitudes today. We always love to give specific shout outs to anybody that has the opportunity to leave us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts, but no new names. If you would like a shout out, we would love to say thank you to you personally.
Yeah.
What you can do is go to your podcast app, go to the show at the bottom. You can actually click 5 stars, write a review if you'd like to leave your name. But in general, whether or not you've done that, if you've been a listener for a little bit, or if it's your first time, thanks for joining us. We're so glad to have these conversations with you where we talk about all kinds of topics that help us to create the kind of culture we want for our churches, our families, and our personal lives. So today's going to be a little bit more of a, I guess, a meta type of church conversation. I think this applies probably to church leaders, but also to people just that are, you know, invested in seeing.
Yeah, well, it should apply to everybody, because one of the big challenges that, you know, the central challenge, I should say, that Jesus made to every one of his followers is that we would make disciples.
Right.
And one of the things that we have been sort of talking around over the last couple of years is that 2020 and the pandemic that hit exposed some superficiality within the church. And one of the biggest exposures is the fact that very, very few Christians have ever made a disciple intentionally.
Right.
And, you know, probably even more have never been intentionally discipled. So we have a lot of people who've been brought into churches and they're participating in programs and services, but the process of discipleship is the big question. But it's beyond that. Like, that's the micro. The macro is, as church leaders, how should we be building church, you know, in general? Are there some principles that are correct? So do we have a title for this particular episode, Dave?
I think the idea is there a right way to do church? Or maybe is there a right way to do discipleship? I don't know how we want to, we'll probably get into a lot. I'm actually like going through my notes here and I'm realizing, oh, I have even more that I'm going to combine this with another episode.
And I just should say too, part of what makes this conversation work is, so Dave comes into the conversation with a pebble in your shoe, or what do they say, makes the pearl in the clam. There's some irritant or dust that gets in there that under pressure creates something good. You come into this conversation with something that you're a little bit bothered by, curious about. And then we have a intergenerational conversation about it theologically. And we come at it from the perspective that we don't know everything, but we're going to at least try to kind of dice it up into things that maybe are applicable or that we really need to wrestle through. So what's the pebble in your shoe?
All right. So let me think about how I want to get this started. So if we go to like I'll say this, I'll bring this to a personal point that will start the conversation, but let me do a little more framing just in case there's people that maybe aren't as familiar with this idea. So there are all these different kinds of church models right now. And probably there are proponents from every camp that are claiming like this is really the right way to do church. The way we would talk about this is like, this is the closest thing we have to the early church, the book of Acts. And, you know, somebody would tout what aspect of their model really is hitting this book of Acts thing. You know, so like, so the smaller church, whether it's like house church or micro church or a bunch of life groups is like,
so you're throwing around some terminology that maybe if you're a new Christian, this may even be foreign to you. So all of this sort of ends up in the frame of maybe the Western version of church is wrong. And we're talking about typically the interdenominational or Pentecostal charismatic world. So it's sort of like, are mega churches the right kind of church?
Yeah, churches over 3,000.
Are churches that are heavily programmed with sort of some polish and excellence and even glitz the right way to do church? Are the churches that have the biggest crowds the best churches?
Or maybe, they have the most flow for the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, or maybe it's the opposite of that. Maybe it's the smallest church or the smaller church that's pure and the larger church is infected with some kind of compromise. Well, maybe even really build a church that's large without some kind of compromise. Maybe those larger churches aren't really focused on preaching the gospel.
Well, the smaller church thing would be this. It's that with bigger churches, we often have one guy from the stage.
Personality driven.
Yeah, that's talking to everybody. Whereas in these smaller movements, you have a lot more, like the term is life on life discipleship.
Yeah, and then you see these examples of the house church movement in China, which is under intensive persecution and is rapidly multiplying and producing what appears to be some very robust kind of Christians. Mm-hmm. And then you look at it, the American culture, and you see a lot of Christians don't know what they believe. They're not really living in obedience to the precepts or teachings of Jesus. They may have a synchronistic view of theology. They're not making a disciple intentionally, but they're going to a great program on a weekend and being motivated and with some good music and some good teaching. And is all of this just shallow and hollow?
Sure.
And how should church be being done in the very first place? So that's the larger narrative that we're diving into.
Yeah. So I can do the sand and the clamshell. So here's, I think, like where I would start. And I have a lot of bunny trails we could go down with this, but here's where I would start. I have a friend that is leading a ministry I greatly respect, and they're doing an amazing job of winning people to Jesus and then of quickly empowering those people to, you know, hit the streets, if you will, and seeing other people saved. And there's this, one of the coolest things about, you know, this ministry that my friend's leading is like they seem to be very much like reproducing new Christians that are able to make new Christians. And it's through a sort of this smaller life groups model with they call it life on life discipleship. And my friends, you know, I won't talk about it directly. My friend's one of those more, you know, sometimes he'll say like a very what do you call it, a very big hot take, you know, like here's what I think. And I'm not even sure he meant this in all seriousness or to the degree that it sounded, but he was like, you know, I'm not sure I was ever discipled. Like grew up in church, you know what I mean? Like great church, like, you know, great youth group. But like what he meant by that, I think, was I'm not sure I'd ever had someone that took me under their wing to teach me about all the ways of following Christ on a life-on-life way, the way that we're doing now. So I guess to spark this whole conversation, my question is like, you know, is discipleship this sort of Jesus 12 life on life thing, and then like most churches are missing discipleship in general? Like, can discipleship happen in a different way? Is it less effective in a large setting than it is in a small setting? Is it more effective in some ways? Because I genuinely have just been having lots of these curious conversations. Like there is a big push against the mega church Western model because the idea is that you can't really see life change or transformation if it's only a distant I attend and I don't have someone else, like the friction of them holding me accountable and teaching me these things. So that's why I say, is there a right way to do church, or maybe is there a right way to do discipleship? I guess maybe the starting question is like, how would you actually term, like, what is discipleship? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So a disciple is somebody who technically, if you would look at Jesus and his disciples, Jesus was the rabbi. The disciples were like understudies to the rabbi.
Apprentices,
and they were learning his way of life. So what makes this foreign to us is that we are used to a Western culture version of education in general, mm-hmm. which is that you have a person who has knowledge, and then you have students that want that knowledge, and the goal is to learn certain set of principles or facts or skill sets so that you can pass a test. Ancient Eastern training was more, I want to become this person. So this person is the model of what I want to be.
Yeah.
It's not so much, I want to know what this person knows. I want to be what this person is.
Yeah.
And so Jesus was trying to reproduce his character and nature, which involved things that he knew and understood, but it was way more the application of that knowledge to a lifestyle.
Yeah.
That was the process of discipleship. So being a follower of Jesus is becoming like Christ in my attitudes, in my thoughts, in my life patterns, in my habits, in my mission, in my purpose. It's adopting a person's character and nature as you're target. And so producing a disciple is producing a little Christ, someone who is becoming like Christ.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of people who are going to church events, and they're maybe passing theology courses even, but they're not, like, how many of us know somebody that's held a position in a church or even has a degree, but doesn't look at all like Jesus?
Yeah, right.
In terms of the way that they're living or how they act or how they treat people. So you can be in the system of religion and not becoming a person that looks like Jesus.
Yeah, right.
So discipleship, right?
Yeah, I'm reading this book, another John Mark Comer book that he recently released called Following the Way. And he had a really interesting point about discipleship. He was saying that the way the word discipleship is, a lot of times we use it as a verb. He's like, it's really not meant to be a verb. Like, a disciple is a noun. You really can't...
Something that you are.
Something that you are. So he's like, when somebody says nobody discipled me, he's like, that's a thing. So he's like, you wouldn't say like nobody Christianed me, like either you are or you aren't.
Right.
And he was saying like, really like the person that we're apprenticing under is Jesus. So like it's not that he's invalidating the idea that there should be people that are showing us how to act like Jesus, but his idea is whether or not you are a disciple is whether or not you've made a personal choice to become like Jesus, not just in your thinking and agreeing with beliefs, but in your lifestyle.
So let me come back to the question that your friend, I don't know that anyone intentionally discipled me. I was a part of a good church in youth group, but I don't know if I was ever intentionally discipled. I would have to say that's true for me too.
Mm.
I don't know that anyone ever said to me directly, you will now be my mentee. Apprentice.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I'm now going to personally walk with you through a process of discipleship so that at the end of this, you become more of a follower of Jesus. No one ever specifically did that for me.
Right.
What I was around was a collection of really amazing Christ followers who were becoming like Jesus, who affected me. And some of that happened as I was in church services with them and heard them preach. Some of this happened as I lived in their house, my dad, mom.
Right.
Some of this happened as I was hanging out with them in fellowship times in the foyer. Some of this happened as I observed how they responded in situations. It was a collection of exposure to somebody who had it, that it was imparted onto me through that process. Now, I was hungry for it.
Yeah.
Like when I gave my life to Jesus, I was hungry. Like I wanted to grow. I wanted to know more. I asked questions. I pursued people. I volunteered. I served. I got in proximity next to people who were following Jesus, and it affected me. And somehow I am where I am now. Okay. So I do think sometimes we can get overly focused on methodology and size. So if it's small, it's discipleship. It's big, it's not. If it's an intentional process that involves a curriculum, it with steps, it's discipleship. If it isn't intentional with steps, it's not. But if you really look at the discipleship methodology of Jesus, he didn't have a curriculum. Like he didn't say, okay, guys, today open your notebook to chapter one.
Sure.
He used teachable moments. So he was around them enough to where he bumped into things that happened in the world. And then he pulled his disciples aside and he said, by the way, that woman who just gave those two pennies, she gave more than everybody. I want you to take note of that. Like it was as they were doing life together, he imparted to them who he was and how he thought. But it wasn't necessarily an intentional methodology. So I have to say that that's wrong to have, we're going to have coffee every Tuesday and we're going to talk about the following 12 chapters in this book and I'm going to disciple you that way. That's great. But Jesus' methodology was life on life, but it wasn't necessarily all that, I think everybody got a sort of a designer plan for where they were and what they needed to be confronted about.
Yeah.
Or challenged by. So I mean, if I'll ask you, so you grew up in my house, of course, in the church that I lead, were you intentionally, would you be able to say, this is the person who discipled me?
I mean, other than you, I did.
But I did as a dad. I mean, technically, dads and moms, that's one of our primary responsibilities.
Yeah.
Is to teach our kids what it is to be like Jesus.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I had a lot of people that I rubbed shoulders with enough to where they did that, but not maybe in a definitely not in a one-on-one setting as much.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like Colin Allen, Pastor Colin Allen, who's now in Des Moines, you know.
Pastor of Reach Church.
Yeah.
He was on staff at Allison Park for 22 years and was your youth pastor, right?
Yeah, big
and
then, shout out to Pastor Colin.
And then your boss. And
yeah, you Joe know, Schaefer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Joe is a big, and they, I would say both of them, you know, taught me a lot of different things, but yeah, probably not ever in that formal setting. I think for me, this is part of what I just think feels true, whether or not it is true. I think for me, it wasn't just the decision to follow Christ, like just to raise my hand. When I was like hungry enough, I was going to pick up what I picked up because I wanted to, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I sort of feel like, okay, I think that the amazing, amazing benefit that I'm seeing from this model of life on life, smaller stuff is like people pick, they're hungry, they're a little hungry, but they pick up so much whether they want to or not because it's like, hey, would you join this model? Of course. And it's like almost like being like force fed. Like it's like, you know, they don't even have to just eat the meals that they find the food. It's like, we're plugging an IV into you and we're going to shoot this rapid fire in. And it does seem to have results and effects.
Yeah, well, and some of this, I think, to a degree, is cultural. And here's what I mean. Okay, so culture has an effect on the speed with which discipleship works and the obstacles that have to be overcome.
Mm.
So here's what I mean. My father-in-law, David Spencer, pastored in Nicaragua for many years, and they had a method of doing ministry that involved meeting three times a week.
Yeah.
In addition to church. Okay, so typically it was you meet with your leader, then you have a group of people that you're meeting with that you're pouring into, and then we do some kind of monthly evangelistic outreach. And in Nicaragua, where it is, the pace of life is slower, and the pressure to produce a certain amount of income is not available. and the culture accepts the authority of a top-down model where somebody says, this is what you're going to do,
right,
and everybody does it. That culture allows for there to be more rapid discipleship-making methods because of both the time and the readiness to receive direction.
Uh-huh.
American culture is individualistic and busy, and you got kids and two jobs and pressure from everywhere. So once you get a couple of kids in your life, and if you have a job or two, and the trend is now people are attending church less and less, so you're in proximity with people less. So I know the friend that you're talking about, this discipleship method works in young adult culture where people are on a campus together, focused. This the freedom of being childless and spouseless gives you the ability to do things at a rapid pace where you can hook people up to an IV and they get it really quickly. When you're dealing with multi-generational, fast-paced, individualistic, affluent culture, I don't care who you are, where you function, that is going to have an impact because these are obstacles that have to be overcome. In a purist view, everyone in the world would make time in their busy schedules to make discipleship the central priority of life. But even if that is your central priority, there are still so many obstacles to overcome. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a third culture that it does appear that this works in, and that's in when you're in a culture under intense persecution and you're functioning underground because you've been driven there, and the only people that are actually Christ followers are those who are willing to give their whole lives for it.
Yeah.
And there is no above ground popular culture church world to belong to, because if you identify as a Christian, you might be killed, lose your job, or be kicked out of your family. Right. It does appear under the pressure of persecution. in an environment where there is little distraction due to children, jobs, and families, and in a I would say slower paced culture, which allows for more time, that you can do all of these things of making disciples at a greater pace.
Yeah.
I think above ground in a Western culture, there are obstacles to overcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, Dave, when you got a baby, your life changed, right? You work, Sarah works. There's times of the day where she's working and you're watching James, and there's times of the day she's working and you're working and she's watching James. And then you have the obligations of family, and then you have the financial pressures, and then you have the schedules of things, mm-hmm. and trying to fit in everything else is a challenge.
Sure.
It's not to say it can't be done or that we shouldn't strive to get there in the ideal world, but to ignore the fact that there are natural cultural obstacles in some situations, then you end up just having this idealistic view of the world that doesn't have any practical value in your daily experience.
So there's this, okay, so like when we talk about the book of Acts, and it, you know, it talks about how they met together daily and broke bread and studied the word kind of a thing. Like, I think that is an advantage of these sort of like models that are life on life and, you know.
Yeah, but again, the culture of that day, when we're talking about Jesus was in a life on life. So Jesus was not the only rabbi making disciples. This was the way everyone was trained in the Jewish culture. Jewish culture was also a little bit like Nicaragua. It was a slower pace. Jesus and his disciples walked everywhere. So like they didn't have this hop on the internet, get on social media, fly down the road at 70 miles an hour to another appointment. Jesus would minister and then walk with his disciples and debrief with them on the way. Uh-huh. It was a much slower paced culture. It was a discipleship oriented environment.
Right.
And there was less of the obstacles of our current fast paced society. Now, it's not to say we don't want to get back there. It's just to say those obstacles are real and have to be dealt with in every individual's life that you're trying to disciple, because their obstacles have to be overcome.
Yeah.
But even in the New Testament church, this is what no one likes to talk about. They were a mega church. The first day the church was born, they were a mega church. 3,000 people got saved the first day. And they would meet in huge crowds at the temple courts, sometimes daily.
Yeah.
And they would hear the apostles preach and teach in these. So right around the temple courts, there was a big patio, platformed area where people would gather for worship in a Jewish sense. But you could gather thousands of people that would stand under the covering of Solomon's colonnade, which was like a little pavilion space all around the temple courts. And so they would meet, thousands of people would meet together. And then they also would get into smaller groups and have fellowship. And then there was this rabbinic idea of life on life discipleship that was all a part of the growth process of the early New Testament church. Wouldn't it be great if we could remove the obstacles of Western culture?
Sure.
Get everybody off social media, get everybody deplatformed. Everybody goes back
with a little less
to organic, and we were all simple.
Right.
And you know, everyone had enough money to be able to do what we were, and we were living communally. And I mean, okay, you almost have to deconstruct Western culture to get into a place where you have the ease with which you can do some of these things. And actually, I think part of the process of discipleship is helping people deconstruct the pressures of Western culture so that they can spend time in daily prayer and studying the Bible, yeah. making a priority on relationships. So part of our discipleship method is teaching people how to manage the pressures of life,
yeah.
and move away from the busy pace and the dominating narratives to get in touch with what it is to become like Jesus and to get in community.
Agreed.
Where you can follow Christ.
Well, the great thing too about the gospel is it is cross-cultural, and it looked different for Gentile churches than it looked for Jewish churches, you know, even back 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, it
looks still different parts of the world. And there are parts of culture that are barriers to Christianity, certainly.
And there are parts that are advantages. Like, for instance, we can spread the gospel message online and reach people that we would never reach because you had to be in physical proximity with every person that you were winning to Jesus. That's clearly an advantage that our culture has over previous cultures. I would say the idea of global evangelism is possible now due to transportation advancements and technological advancements that wasn't available to the disciples back in the day that has made ministry improved, not less effective. So we just have to recognize that you can't idealize the New Testament. You have to actually interpret it culturally.
Yeah.
You can't say this is the way everything should be and then live in a pipe dream.
Sound like you're saying that about what Jesus taught, though. You just mean in terms of methodology?
Methodology.
Great, okay.
Yeah, methodology. So the methodology of the New Testament has to be contextualized to the culture that you're in.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah. So I have two directions to take this. I have more of a corporate church one, and then I have more of a personal disciple, like I am a disciple.
Yep.
Well, you want to start with corporate church, maybe? We'll start there.
Sure.
So, like, you were never one-on-one discipled by, I guess, your dad, but in general, that wasn't an intentional.
Yeah, so this is hard for me to evaluate because I could show up in my dad's world any morning at breakfast or any evening at dinner and ask him a Bible question and he would give me an answer.
Sure.
Right, so that's not really fair. Not everybody has that advantage. Everybody needs somebody in their life like that.
Yeah, right.
To say, I was reading or I had this question or somebody said something to me. And I could say, what do you think about this? And so that was helpful. I tried to be that for you.
Yeah, you were. Yeah.
Growing up. Yeah. Sure. So there was these teachable moments. Everybody needs somebody in their life like that.
Okay. Yeah.
But no, like the youth pastor looked in on me.
Yeah.
But I was basically just serving in the youth group. And I would go to Bible studies and not a Bible study leader, but I was there in a small sense. It wasn't like someone was constantly saying, now here's the next thing you need to do. Mm-hmm. Like it was through normal church programming that it happened.
So this is, I guess, my question. Like, obviously it wasn't an accident that you became a good disciple of Jesus. It was what your church intended. But I guess, like, it does feel possible, and we've all seen this, that it doesn't even have to be a large church setting, but in a setting where it's based around service and programs— it seems like it's pretty easy for some people to sort of slip through the cracks and come to things, but not really ever make a choice to become a disciple. I realize that's equally a personal choice as much as it is a corporate responsibility of a church. But I guess I'm saying, like, how do we know, like how do we know we're getting towards depth? How do we know we're getting towards life-changing, transformational discipleship as opposed to just programs? So if we're not in a life-on-life small setting, from a corporate setting, what do we do to make sure that we're there? Does that make sense, my question?
Yeah. So I think some of this is related to church size. So let's say you have a small church of less than 100 people,
uh-huh,
and you have a very active, attentive pastor. It doesn't take much to know someone's missing or someone needs to have a conversation. Actually, a lot of good discipleship happens in a small environment with a really, really effective pastor who is shepherding his flock, mm-hmm, by paying attention to the needs of its congregation. And a lot of times in a small church with an effective pastor who's shepherding his flock, the people who attend that church get from that pastor what I had with my dad. They have access to him or her. They can go up to them and say, I have this question, and they can get personal pastoral attention. And then the small environments of church and other activities, they get into the flow of something and they're known, they're recognized, they're challenged, they're developed because you have a good pastor in your life who's developing you. Yeah. Once you get past the 100 mark, then you have to have a church that has multiple pastors doing that, but it's harder.
Yeah.
Now you can't see when everyone's missing. So when you get into a church of thousands, now it feels like this is just a machine.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just a number here. No one even knows my name or situation. I couldn't even ask a question if I wanted to. But boy, is the music great. And man, I could be living a crazy sinful life and come in here and pretend like I'm good. And no one would know the difference because there's no accountability. Okay, there's a serious weakness there. Like, okay, so you've grown a church large enough because you're effective as a communicator, or you've got a great program or plan, or because you're in a growing community and you're producing something that it has enough excellence on it that people feel like they want to belong to it. Oh, that's really good, by the way. You don't want to be a terrible communicator or build a bad program or not have excellence, but then you're going to draw a whole bunch of people that they could actually swim in that environment for a long period of time and never really be known,
yeah,
never have anyone to challenge them. And they could actually almost deceive themselves into thinking that because I'm a part of this great organization, I'm a great Christian. And what we realized through the pressures of the last couple of years is that that can be highly superficial. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that can also happen though in a small church, right?
For sure, people, of course.
If there's not an effective pastor,
but probably more easily happen.
Easily happen where there's a huge crowd.
Right.
Okay. So that begs the question. Large churches who've built effective communication and great music and good programming and excellence in what they do and are attracting a crowd, how do they take what they have and make sure that discipleship is not missed in the process?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't think you have to get rid of the mega to make discipleship available for people so that if they are hungry for it, they can reach out and find it and be challenged to go to the next level.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we're grappling with right now.
Yeah, that's absolutely what we're grappling with. This has been something we've been wrestling with for a couple of years, and I don't think we have fixed it, but we're certainly attempting to. I think, some of this is providing resources to our people that are ready to make a disciple. You know, they're
so we're trying to create actually a program for developing people who are able to make disciples effectively, trying to create the my dad's personality over and over and over, where somebody knows enough and is living strong enough for Christ enough where they could be that person for somebody else. Yeah. And then being able to point the new believer or the hungry believer to somebody that they could connect with it, that could help them grow and develop. So this is now a matching program. It's tools, and it's a connection point where this can begin to happen.
And I hope we get to the point of where, I mean, I'm talking years down the road, maybe less, I guess if God does this faster, but I would love to get to a point of where we have this part of our culture where people are pursuing, looking for people that they can help to raise up and to reproduce.
Well, because this is what Jesus, the one, so he basically told us two things.
Yeah.
Love.
Yep.
Love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbors, yourself. Make disciples.
Yeah.
Like that's his, if you could boil down what Jesus told his followers to do. And I think everybody gets the love God, love your neighbor part. But I think it's almost like people see making disciples as an optional thing.
Or as the pastor's job.
Yeah. No one would say, love God, love your neighbor. That's optional. Everybody would say, no, that's essential. Go and make disciples of all nations. That's, people see it as optional because number one, it hasn't been done for them or they didn't recognize that it was being done.
Well, that's my next question.
Or number two, they haven't adopted that as mission critical to their life as love God, love your neighbor.
Yeah.
So that becomes now this gap in the Western culture church with all of the busyness of life.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So let's get into my second question then. We've talked about this a little bit, but it was actually a topic that I had. And I was like, oh, this is a good way to fit this in. Cause you, I think when we talked about it, you weren't sure if it'd fit as a whole topic. You said this earlier, most Christians have never made a disciple. Probably true. We don't know that for sure, but that's not a hard thing to guess that most have not. Okay. So, let me read from Luke chapter 8 really quick, this parable of the sower that Jesus tells, and then I'll give a question off of this. So, Luke 8:4 says, as a large crowd was gathering and the people were flocking to him from every town, he said in a parable, a sower went out to sow his seed. As he was sowing, some fell along the path, it was trampled on, and the birds of the sky ate it up. Other seed fell on the rock. When it sprang up, it withered since it lacked moisture. Other seed fell among thorns. The thorns sprang up with it and choked it. Still other seed fell on good ground. When it sprang up, it produced a crop 100 times what was sown. As he said this, he called out, anyone who has ears to hear should listen. And then he goes on to sort of tell his disciples what this means. And he says this is the meaning of the parable. This is in verse 11. The seed is the word of God. The seed along the path are those who have heard. And then the devil comes and takes away the word from their hearts so that they may not have believed and be saved. Or they may not be believed and be saved. And the seeds on the rock are those who, when they hear, welcome the Lord with joy. Having no root, these believe for a while and depart in a time of testing. As for the seed that fell among the thorns, these are the ones who, when they have heard, go on their way and are choked with worries, riches, and the pleasures of life, and produce no mature fruit. But, and here's the key part, but the seed in the good ground, these are the ones who, having heard the word with an honest and good heart, hold on to it by enduring and bear fruit. And I think there's another, I think it's in Matthew where he says they produce a crop of 30, 60, 100 times.
Yeah.
The idea of the good seed reproduces itself, meaning makes disciples. They love God, they endure through the faith, and they make disciples of their own. So, leads me to my question. Is spiritual reproduction, reproducing yourself by making to other disciples, is that a requirement of being good seed? Is that a requirement of salvation?
Not a requirement. It's an evidence.
Okay.
Don't you think?
Okay, sure.
So it's clearly
elaborate,
an evidence.
Elaborate.
An evidence is, so if the seed was planted properly in a good soil, the evidence is that it produced fruit. Mm-hmm. If the seed doesn't produce fruit, you would say something's wrong.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That's not a requirement, is a precursor.
Okay.
If this is good seed, then it has to produce fruit to prove that it's a good seed. Well, now technically the fruit comes later. So the key is cultivating the soil so that the production happens as an evidence.
Okay.
So it's an evidence.
Is it an evidence that it's not there means that you're not good seed?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about this in a minute. So I think...
I'm not trying to be harsh here, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm more just, it's a question that when I read that verse, it sounds so intense to be like, the only evidence of good seed is enduring and reproducing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, so if I'm not reproducing yet, does that mean I'm not a good seed? You know what I'm saying?
So let's broaden the discussion though. Okay, so I think there is something about, we have a tendency to reduce discipleship down into a process of steps.
Okay.
And I think that that's part of the journey. So I meet with you and you answer my questions and I look at you and you demonstrate things for me. And we have this understanding that you are mentoring me and I'm following you so I could become more like Christ. But some of the people that most impacted me, Dave, in my journey, I only met with a few times.
Yeah.
But they were so full of Jesus. They had so much on their life. The anointing of God was so strong through them that a few encounters with them changed me to this day.
Yeah.
And if you were to ask them, did you disciple Jeff Leake? They would tell you no, because they wouldn't see it as a regular meeting where they were intentionally a mentor in my life. But they, if you were to ask me, do I look at them as one of the spiritual influences on my life that makes me what I am today? I would have to say absolutely.
Who's one of those people you're talking about?
Okay, so I have so many of them, but David Cartledge is one. He was an Australian leader that I met in the early 2000s. He came and preached for me a couple of times, and we had lunch or dinner maybe 15 times in my whole life. But there were things he spoke to me directly, prophetically. There were some things that I heard him say. There was a way that he thought and approached life that still to this day has shaped my worldview.
Wow.
and my function.
Yeah.
And here's what I'll say. Something got imparted into me at that moment. So when we look at Paul and Timothy, that's clearly a discipleship relationship. But there was, Paul talks about fan into flame the gift of God that was given to you with the laying on of hands. Something got imparted onto Timothy, and it was a singular experience that happened for Timothy. Yes, there was a relationship that Paul and Timothy had where Paul teaches him things, but some of the spirit on Paul got rubbed off on Timothy.
Yeah.
So I would say this, you may not be able to, as a Christian, look back over a lifetime and say, these are the 20 people that I entered a process of discipleship with, that we completed a curriculum, and the outcome I could say, these are the 20 people I discipled. But there would be people in your life, if you truly have lived as an on-fire disciple for Jesus, that will say, they were an influence on me. Like you will have people who will credit where they are today in their walk with God to your influence,
yeah,
even if you only had a conversation with them two or three times.
Yeah. So use that matrix that you talked about, that the three
okay,
elements.
Okay, so Mark Middleberg wrote a book called Contagious Christianity a number of years back, probably 25 years ago now. And in that, he has an equation for evangelism that I think also is an equation for discipleship. He says this, high potency, which is what I'm talking about, a Christian who has something on them that they carry, right? High potency plus close proximity, where I'm around you, right? What you are rubs off on me because we're life on life.
Yep.
Okay. Plus clear communication, mm-hmm. where you're being able to describe, this is what we believe, this is what we teach, this is what the answer is to that question.
Sure.
Equals maximum impact.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're lacking one of these, if you're lacking high potency, you'll be able to be in close proximity, but there is nothing to rub off because you don't have it that much on you. So if you get around a few times with someone who has just got the touch of God on their life, mm-hmm. because they're hungry and they're fasting and they're seeking God and they're growing, being around a person who has high potency for a short period of time can change the trajectory of your life for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Okay. If you don't have high potency, something's missing. If you don't have proximity, if you're never around them, if all you get is a video screen, you can have high potency there. But if I never get to rub up against you, I don't really know the authentic way that you apply this in your everyday life. I can't get a sense of how this works for you. I can only hear you teaching it. So you need high potency, you need close proximity, and then you need clear communication where we are actually articulating biblical theology and the answers to questions and what it is to follow Jesus and how to make this work in everyday life. If you have packaged that all together, then you have maximum impact.
We were talking about how, like, sometimes you can have an effect on someone even with just 2 out of 3.
Which is why.
Yeah.
Like you can impact someone just with high potency. Mm-hmm. Like just an encounter. Like, there's one guy that prayed for me back in 1998 that I had 3 or 4 conversations with. My father-in-law introduced me to, but just the moment where he laid his hands on me changed me.
Yeah.
And I mean, okay, so there can be momentary experiential impartation that happens with a high potency individual. Mm-hmm. And probably all of us can say, I had some seminal moments in my life with God where somebody taught me, prayed over me. I had an experience with the Holy Spirit, or I was on a missions experience. And this high potency environment I was in, it actually gave me more. And like I remember, Dave, the first time you went to Africa and you were serving with SOS, that 2-week high potency experience probably advanced the ball for your discipleship as much as 20 Bible studies, maybe more than that.
More than that.
Okay, so yeah, that's what I mean.
Probably like, as much as 5 years.
It's like the injection of a steroid into the system that all of a sudden you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like I just passed go, and you know, I moved up, like advanced so many spaces in a short period of time because I had this experiential dynamic that was imparted onto my life. But you also need that person to show up at breakfast to and say, can you make sense of this for me? Like, how do you love your wife in this moment? How do you handle this situation with your finances? I feel prompted by God to give, and I don't think I can afford this, but do I obey this? And how do I obey it? Like, you need someone to help you process it so that you know how to handle things. And then eventually you need clear communication. There probably is another one to this, and that is—
What's clear communication? Sorry.
Clear communication is where somebody is giving you— they're teaching you the way of Jesus in a way that's both understandable and applicable.
Great. Okay. What's the fourth one you were going to say?
I think maximum impact with discipleship, we'd have to add one, and that is personal application, where you're actually doing it then.
Yeah.
Right? So or obedience, where you're actually then taking everything you've learned and doing this for somebody else.
Yeah.
I actually think when you start to give it out, this is actually your friend's... what makes their system work is not just that they have a process of teaching people the clear communicated material. Mm-hmm. It's that quickly they're being brought into the thing where everything you've got, now we want you to pass it along to somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and actually that's what accelerates growth so quickly. And what's so lacking in the crowd-based programmatic megachurch is that people are never put in a position where they have to give it out. Mm-hmm. They're always in the recipient mode. Uh-huh. And they're never put in a position to say, now you take what you just got taught and take that and teach that over here. And then that's when you really learn it.
Yeah.
Because then you have to grapple with, do I really believe this? Is this really correct? How does this work? And they're going to ask you questions, right? So something is missing in the journey of discipleship in that a lot of times the people who have received the input are not passing it on to somebody else. And that is the fatal flaw in why the process stops.
Yeah.
Even in a small church where you're being pastored effectively.
Yeah.
If you are not actually passing it on to somebody else, you stunt your growth if it stops with you.
Sure.
You stunt your growth and development and stop the process, this chain reaction that Jesus wanted discipleship to be in the world.
So if someone...
And actually, when you went on that Africa trip, it wasn't just that you were around high-potency people doing incredibly dynamic things with the Holy Spirit. It's that you were preaching and you were leading and you were being pressed into service.
For sure.
So this demand on you need to do something with what you have can come in a lot of ways. Sometimes it's when people are sent on a trip for the first time and they realize, wow, there's more in me than I thought there was. I should be giving out stuff.
Yeah.
Right. So there's all kinds of ways this gets activated in someone's life.
So if someone does not, they're not able to easily identify ways they're reproducing themselves right now. What are some steps you could take to begin to have fruit?
Yeah. So challenge yourself to get into spaces where you have to give something.
Like what?
A missions trip would be one to go on. Okay. That would be someplace easy to start. Any serve activity or life group activity that requires something of you.
Okay.
Right? So if you host a group, that requires something of you. If you start volunteering for something regularly, that requires something of you. And where you start to show up and look at the people that you're serving on a regular basis and saying, I want to make an impact on their life. Actually, this can even happen with little kids. If you serve in the preschool and you show up every week and you're like, I want to speak into the life of this 3-year-old.
Yeah.
Because actually, you can make an impact on somebody's life even though they're small. Like discipleship doesn't start when you hit 13 or 18 or it's anybody that you're going to pray over or speak over. But if you're not giving out, then you're probably not really, you're never going to get to a place where you're going to make a disciple if you're never giving out, if all you ever do is receive, right? How would you add to that? What are ways that people could give out that would be important?
I think that, so you mentioned, I like everything you mentioned. I would say like, there's a certain point when I think some people start to feel like they're stagnating because they're doing something to serve a ministry program, which is great. But sometimes what the missing piece is having a relationship with somebody else that you're actually investing into, because ultimately like that close proximity I'm pouring into you with clear communication intentionally is like a powerful thing that I think every Christian should experience at some point. Like I'm going to speak into their life and I'm going to pray with them.
I think some of it has to do with taking responsibility.
Yeah.
It's not just taking a role.
Yeah.
It's taking a responsibility. So let me go into my own personal testimony. I got saved when I was 15 years old at a youth camp. I was already in a youth group. I was already in a good church. I was under the leadership of my father, who was an amazing man of God. But after getting saved, the Holy Spirit said to me, I want you to reach your school. Mm-hmm. And I said yes to that. I said, God, I want to reach Gateway High School. Okay, so that internal decision that I want to do something to reach my friends with the gospel started me on a journey. So then I said, God, I can't do this alone. Send me somebody. And I met my friend Kevin, who became my best friend through high school. And together we started to pray that we could do something for our high school. And then, you know, other people heard about our dream to reach our high school. And the next thing you know, we had a prayer meeting that was going on before class. Now, that's when my youth pastor said, let me help you with this. Uh-huh. How are you going to do this? Who's going to lead in prayer? What's the format for this? And so he taught us some things, and then we started practicing it. Yeah. And then God blessed it, and we grew. The next thing you know, we had 50 students standing in a circle before class that are praying. So now we're like, we don't know what we're doing. How do we handle this? So then we started to do a little, we sat everybody on the bleachers and we started to do a little devotional. And then I opened up my house on Tuesday nights and we started having people come over. Look, it wasn't me just following someone else's program. It was me saying, God, I want you to use me. And when he gave me a burden for something, I started to act on it.
Yeah.
And I think I'm here today as the pastor of Allison Park Church years and years later. Because I said yes to the first thing God asked me to do, which was to take responsibility for my school.
Right.
I think people are way more capable of taking responsibility for something in their sphere of influence than they realize. And when you move from a dependency status that I'm coming to a church program to be fed and into an activation status where you're saying, I believe God's going to use me.
Yeah.
Then the people who are speaking into your life have greater value because they're giving you information you're preparing to use, mm-hmm. not just information that you're not sure how this applies or when this is ever going to be good, but were you planning on actually doing something with what you've been given? That's the key. So in a large church, the goal is not just discipling hundreds upon hundreds of people. It's activating them to become people who take responsibility for something God's calling them to do and for people that God's calling them to reach.
Yeah.
In that pregnant environment,
yeah.
I think really great discipleship can happen. Yeah. But if that actually happens on a large scale, you have a revival.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if it really happens in a church where thousands of people attend, poof, look out. Now you're going to have a movement going on, which is really what Christianity was designed to be.
Yeah,
that's not what we're trying to do. Not little tiny church pockets of things, but a revolution that can change a city. That's what you read about in the book of Acts.
Yeah. Okay, so boiling it down, if somebody wants to do this, take a step to produce fruit, take responsibility.
So I would just say, ask this very dangerous question of God. God, what do you want me to do? What area? Not what ministry do you want me to serve in? That's a small question. God, is there some part of this world that's broken? Some people group that needs to be reached? Some ministry that needs to be? What do you want to do in my life?
Yeah.
Just start to ask God that question. Mm. And here's the thing. He will answer you.
Yeah, yeah.
He's actually waiting for people to ask that.
Yeah, it's true.
And part of the discipleship journey will start to accelerate in your life when you start to ask and answer that question.
Yeah.
And who you're going to disciple will start to be answered by asking that question too.
The question is,
God, what do you want to do with me? Mm. What's the broken place, people group, situation that you want me to do something about?
All right.
And then once you get that, then you'll be saying, I need someone that can help me do this.
Yeah.
Right. So this is not just material to learn. This is becoming like Jesus and being present in your world in a way where you're taking responsibility to try to make a difference and change it. And that is, I think, the fullness of what discipleship should look like. Mm-hmm.
So bottom line, while there's probably not one right model, we do have a responsibility to make sure that everybody is being given the opportunity to follow Jesus well as his apprentice by investing into them. And
to activate them.
And to activate them.
To become carriers of this into their world.
Yeah. And that's probably an important thing for our larger churches or even campuses that are smaller size, like the one I lead, you know, of 120 to 150. It's good for us to like start to ask these questions, like how are we doing with this and how do we improve at this? Because, preaching the gospel and making disciples is the thing.
And if the question, God, what do you want to do with me, seems too big.
Yeah, okay.
Then go to the person you serve under, the pastor you serve with. And you're like, a staff member in the large church that you're a part of, if that's the case, and say, I want to take on some kind of responsibility to make a difference in the world. Would you help me figure that out?
Yeah.
You can be a young Christian. You can be brand new in Jesus and still say, I'm ready now, God. You will accelerate your spiritual development by asking that question of a leader quicker than what Bible facts do I need to know?
You probably still want to ask God, what do you want to do with me in the world?
You do.
I don't think
sometimes that's like really, really intimidating for people.
But still do it.
Yeah.
Start. Saying, if it intimidates you, okay. Yeah. But like you still should ask God that question.
Sure.
And I think that sometimes it can help to find wise counsel from like a pastor who always, we always need people to take more responsibility.
And we also need, so if you've been following Jesus for a long, long time, I would just say your goal should be as high potency a person as you possibly can be.
Yeah.
Full of the Holy Spirit, full of the Word of God, full of faith, full of wisdom, ready to activate at any moment in the power of the Holy Spirit so that you can leave a wake filled with impacted lives behind you. Be that David Cartlidge.
Well, and in close proximity as much as possible.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. But, and if you find a high potency person, get around them as much as you can.
Yeah.
Someone that's got something on their life. Woo.
Yeah.
They're gonna impart something to you, that you can't get any other way.
That's good.
So.
Okay. That's good.
Good conversation.
Cool. I'm not even sure how to wrap that up. Do you have any closing thoughts, or did you just give them?
You are capable of so much more than you realize. When God looks at you, he doesn't see someone who's an infant crawling along that's barely surviving. He sees a world changer. He sees someone that has high capacity. And I think some of it, you have to start with the vision of what Jesus sees in you and begin then to see yourself as the mighty man or woman of God that you are. The discipleship process is just helping you get there. But we believe in you. We want to see you activated for the kingdom.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, that's a good conversation. Appreciate you listening. One way that you can activate in a very small way is by helping us spread the word about this, because that's kind of the goal of this podcast. I mean, we talk about culture creating conversations, but we're really trying to give tools for people to activate the call that God has on your life to reach people and to love people well and to make disciples. And so it's a small thing, but man, even if you could just take 5 minutes to take one of the steps you could do, you can like and subscribe on YouTube. You can share this with friends either through text or social media. You can obviously leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. All those are ways that you can help us to spread the word. We would very much appreciate it. And maybe somebody else down the line will appreciate you doing that by impacting them as well. So if you'd like to partner with us, we would love to ask for your help with that. But yeah, again, hope you enjoyed this conversation. It's always great to have you with us. We'll see you again next time.